episode 197 of Fly Away, a weekly podcast from Outlander Travel about the thing we love most, travel. We're glad you're joining us this week. Our goal is to inform, educate, and inspire. We hope that tuning in for our weekly chats will help push you outside of your comfort zone and add some new experiences to your bucket list. We also welcome ideas for topics, so if there's something you'd like to hear about, please let us know. My name is Elizabeth, and this week I'm joined by fellow Outlander travel agents Sandy, Laura, and Lindsay. This week, we would like to take some time to introduce everyone to our newest addition to the Outlander travel team, Beth Rudine. Like all of us, Beth's love for travel began at an early age with domestic trips all over the Southeast and Florida. Her first trip abroad was in the summer of 1976, when she was but a wee little zygote. After her first year in college, when her grandparents invited her to join them on a trip to Austria, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and Germany, and she fell in love with Europe. In 1981, she spent a summer in Scotland after she graduated from college, and shortly thereafter, she accepted a position with Piedmont Airlines, which added fuel to the proverbial travel fire deep inside of her. In 85, she was hired by a travel agency in Charlotte, North Carolina, where she was trained in the fields of corporate and leisure travel, and her desire to travel only increased. Since that time, Beth has visited much of Europe, some countries several times, and the British Isles with her husband Jim, including England, Norway, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, Russia, France, Germany, Poland, Italy, Greece, Turkey, Mallorca, Spain, and Egypt. Some on land and some by sea.
Sure.
Besides Europe, Beth and Jim have cruised Alaska and many of the Caribbean islands. Beth first visited Israel in the early 90s on a trip led by her mother, and in the years to follow, she became part of the planning process. They would lead more than 8 groups together before her mother passed the baton to her in 2012, and due to her deep faith and love for the people of Israel, Beth hopes she will continue leading groups there for many years to come. And in the meantime, she continues to focus on the corporate travel market. Welcome, Beth!
Yay!
Thank you.
All right, so there's so much
in
that.
I'm glad to be here.
We're so glad to have you. There's so much in that introduction to talk about, but I am fixated on Piedmont Airlines. I remember Piedmont Airlines.
I do too. They were the only ones that flew into Myrtle Beach.
So tell us a little bit about Piedmont and what happened to them and why we don't know who they are now.
Well, Piedmont was a regional, very southern carrier. And when I went to work for them, it was a whole new world for me. I worked outside on the ramp.
Oh, wow.
Moving luggage. And loved it every day except the days that it was raining or the days that it was freezing cold. And on those days, we would actually get in the belly of the plane and hide in between our shifts. It was a great place to work. I loved working for the airline. It was very casual. Travel itself was really different at that time, though. It was travel was still considered a luxury in some ways, and people dressed up when they went to fly, and it was just a whole different world than it is these days.
I miss that.
And I was there for a few years. Piedmont, of course, was, well, maybe not of course, many people don't know perhaps, but they were purchased by US Air,
okay,
which was then purchased by American Airlines.
So they were in no way related to Eastern Airlines, right?
No,
okay.
Not at all.
Okay.
And the company, the travel agency that I went to work for when I left Piedmont, was run by a family who were Eastern Airlines people.
Okay. All right. Yeah, because I remember growing up in Greensboro, it was only Piedmont and Eastern. That was everything. Yes, Laura?
I have a question. Did a plane ever take off when you were hiding out the belly?
No, because we were the ones who drove the machine up to the belly of the plane that you see. I can't
towing it out.
Think what we called it, but the with the belt on it that puts the luggage up into the belly of the plane.
So they couldn't
Sometimes
take off.
There were dogs in there.
Aww.
We would take the dogs out and play with them. Can't do that anymore either.
That is so sweet.
But in those days, the people weren't bringing their support peacocks on the plane,
no,
were they?
They were not. The only support animals they were bringing were actually dogs.
Yeah, go figure. Go figure. The old days. So you were actually that person that was throwing the luggage around, right, Beth? So if my luggage was damaged in the 70s, it was you.
I was throwing luggage around. I was in really good shape. And I did work upstairs at the gates a little bit. I worked at the ticket counter very, very rarely. At that point in time, the management at the Charlotte airport wanted you to be able to do every position that they had. And so we had to do a little bit of everything. And I remember during that time there was a night shift, and the night shift people would, we had little stickers that were in the shape of an airplane, and they said 8A, 8B, 8C, and we would take the stickers for every seat on the plane and physically put the sticker on somebody's boarding pass.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
So that when they got to the airport the next day and they were handed a boarding pass at the ticket counter, it had their seat assignment on it. And we would do that all night long.
Wow.
Oh, man.
That was a long time ago. Like, did people bring covered wagons to the airport?
Actually, they did.
We were getting those kind of boarding passes.
Laura can, I was going to say, Laura can only say that because she remembers getting one of those boarding passes.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
That was during the time, though, when nobody was given the same seat twice, because we literally had each of the pages that had these stickers on. Every flight had one page, of course, and so once the stickers were gone, the flight was full and nobody else was getting a seat.
So is that to say that you never oversold, or it was just the order you put the stickers on decided who got to get on the plane?
The planes were oversold, but the seat, the way that was handled was that when people checked in and were handed their boarding pass, whatever boarding passes were not given out at the ticket counter would be brought down to the gate, and we would use those when the flight was oversold to give out to other people, or if people were standing by for a flight, we could use those leftover seats, if you will, to them.
See, that totally makes sense to me in my old school librarian brain. That's like, that's just like stamping a book. It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's fantastic.
It's like having a card catalog.
Yes, exactly. Oh, those old days.
Exactly.
So is that where you learned, because right now you use a GDS system, which is a skill that we certainly appreciate at Outlander Travel. It's a great skill to have. Is that when you were introduced to the GDS, or was that when you got into the travel agency itself?
I was introduced to the GDS at Piedmont. It was a different system. I have been on Sabre since the mid 80s, but at Piedmont, it was, I guess it was Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
It was not Sabre. It was what Eastern used. I believe Eastern started Apollo. Am I right?
That's possible. I know, isn't Apollo, is Apollo or Amadeus that's Delta? I always get them confused. I know Sabre is American Airlines, but the other ones I don't. Yeah,
I do not.
I do mix them up. So Amadeus is the European one. I think you're right. It might have been United, but
well,
you know, all those get, is that, did
United
Eastern?
Then.
Yeah. Did Eastern get wrapped into United? That, God, I lost track of all those mergers. That was a long time ago.
I know.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago. And we did not use it very much. So much of what we were doing was not computerized at that point, obviously. The seat assignments. Now, one thing that was computerized was the weight and balance. And I worked in weight and balance as few times as I could possibly get away with. And that is where you would, based on the number of people that were confirmed on a flight, and it was completely by the law of averages as to determining what the weight of the people that were going to be on the plane actually would make up. also using a law of averages as to what their luggage would weigh. Let's say we figure if on this plane there are X number of people, and just based on the number of seats, we're going to figure everybody on the plane weighs 150 pounds, and we're going to also guess that they're going to bring two pieces of luggage, and we're going to guess that those pieces of luggage weigh 45 pounds. And we would use the boarding pass system that I've just explained and the seat assignment system, and we would figure out how we needed to distribute the weight on the aircraft.
So then was there actually a scale?
Frightening.
Yeah, that is frightening. So was there a scale to check your work at the end? Because obviously you knew that that was all guesses, or was it literally whatever you decided, you just hoped the plane would take off without leaning to the left?
It was pretty much, that's pretty much how it went.
Wow.
Although I will say that the majority of the people that were in weight and balance had been in there for years and years. And they were able to go back in after the fact, after a flight had taken off, and take some facts from that the aircraft gave it, which would be a much more accurate weight measurement, and then they could go back and determine we need to update our
law of averages.
The way that we do it. But as I said, I was not in weight and balances very much because I hated it.
Yeah,
it scared me to death.
What do they do now? I mean, laws of physics are still the laws of physics.
Yeah, but they actually do have some things built into the planes now, right? That weigh. They can sort of tell how much the plane weighs.
Do.
Yeah. So there's actually, I won't say that the plane is rolled onto a scale, but it's something like that where, I mean, kind of like they just have ways to weigh it. Mathematical calculations.
Well, and there are some scales at some airports similar to the type of scale that you would see in a truck.
Mm. Okay.
If you're on an interstate and the trucks all have to get off so they can get weighed, it would be the same type of scale. They don't do that often. If there was a plane that they knew was going to be heavy, if it was a long flight that was overbooked, and if it is a flight from Miami to Egypt where everybody tries to put 5 foot lockers on the plane.
Right.
That those planes could be weighed every day. I mean, I don't know,
yeah.
But there are ways of weighing the aircraft now.
I've been on aircraft now where they actually tell people in the front to move to the back. They say we need 4 to 5 people to move because the front of the plane's too heavy and there's nobody in the back. And then I've also had situations where they've asked people to take another flight, not because there weren't seats for them, but because we need this plane to weigh less, so we need to put you on another flight. I've been on flight, and usually it's out of Newark coming here. It's happened to me twice, those two situations.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
If they asked me to get off the plane to make the plane lighter.
No, they ask for volunteers. They don't ask, they don't say, if you happen to weigh 223 pounds, and they just ask, they basically, I think, use that law of averages and say we need about 4 people to get off the plane.
We need 3 people to get off the plane. Could you go ahead and get off the
plane? And then we'll figure it out.
Right away.
Okay, now we don't need anybody.
We're good. So
I think if they made that announcement now, I might just be the one to say, I think I'll get off.
Yeah.
Using the same
really?
Pattern we've used.
Yeah. I don't trust this at all. Okay.
I had that happen on Southwest where they like, because you know, you choose your own seat, but if there's only so many people flying, they get really adamant of where you're sitting.
Well, and I mean, there is a point where you probably can tell pretty easily. If you look down the plane and you see that everybody's sitting on the left side of the plane, then it becomes pretty easy to figure that you might need to balance it out. I mean, we actually just got on a boat at Disney World, and for some reason, everybody moved to the left side of the boat and sat down, and my husband was on the left side at the front, and he's like, oh, could somebody get on the right? His head was like almost in the water. He's like, we're leaning.
That happened to us one time. I think you were with me, Lindsay, when we were on the back of that one boat at Disney.
Oh, yeah.
And we're like, my God, this water is close. Yep. Why don't we all go back here and sit in
Yeah, I've definitely seen it happen. Okay, so back to Beth. Sorry, Beth. You bring up so many funny stories. So as we talk about your work experience, there you do have a sort of interesting note on your resume that you have done a lot of travel for some NASCAR drivers. Can you talk about some of your experiences there? Do you have any great stories? You don't have to name names.
Well, I have worked with some drivers and a lot of corporate people, and it, you know, they are the first to tell you that it's not just beer and chicken bones anymore. It is big business. And, but I will say that there are some of the drivers who, think very highly of themselves and they're not used to being told no. And, I lost an account once because I could not confirm a husband and a wife, and I really blame this one on the wife. I could not get them confirmed on a first class flight, on a seat, a first class seat on a particular flight. It was full, and I couldn't get them on it.
And so the wife,
I couldn't get them on it.
The wife just decided you were at fault for that. Is that?
She did. Mm-hmm. Well, she was. She kind of tended to think that anyone but herself was at fault, but. But anyway, she's not even the wife of this driver anymore. But I did have some
well, that explains that.
I haven't even gone in that direction. But yeah, it was a lot of fun to get to know some of these men who were putting themselves in such risk. And when I first started working in this field, I was also a NASCAR fan, and so I knew who a lot of them were, and I knew the ones that were good drivers and the ones that were not so good drivers, and it was a lot of fun for me. I do remember going out to the track once, and I had gotten credentials from one of the drivers, and so we went out to the garage area before the race. I don't remember when it was. It doesn't really matter, but it was a night race, so it must have been May. And we were invited in, myself and another girl were invited into the motor home of this particular driver. Oh. And I just stood with my jaw almost on the floor looking at some of those motor homes and some of the things that they kept out in the infield for the drivers. They were immaculate. They were very ornate. These are not your usual, let's go rent
Winnebago
and travel the East Coast. Yeah, they were amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Probably nicer than my house.
Oh, they were, yeah. But the majority of the people are really a lot of fun. They like good things. They, like I said, they don't like to be told no. And they're used to people asking them constantly, every time they put their head outside a door, asking them for their autograph. And so many of them tend to believe that everybody is completely impressed with them. Mm-hmm. And so some of them, it's funny with some. I will tell you that I did come eye to eye with Dale Earnhardt once, and it almost scared me to death. I don't know if any of you are NASCAR fans, but he was one of the biggest, at least during the time when I first started doing this, and his nickname was the Intimidator, and I can verify that looking eyeball to eyeball with him, it works.
He's not a very tall dude, is he? He's about your height, isn't he?
Well, no, his son is alive now. He's
okay.
No longer alive.
Okay, okay. I'm sorry.
That was his father.
That was my jump. Sorry, I didn't think about that. Okay.
Well, was he mean to you?
I'm probably completely wrong on this, but did he drive car number 43?
He drove three.
Number three. Mm-hmm. 43 was...
my roots are showing.
...was Petty, Richard Petty.
Oh.
Yeah. Another legend.
Jesse Wallace.
So were you booking... You're booking their air. I assume they're taking care of getting their cars from place to place, or were you having to do that for them as well?
I am doing air... No, I'm doing air for them and also hotel blocks, and I still do... The majority of the people that I take care of now are folks that do PR for the drivers or PR for corporate sponsors. And so I might have, it used to be, I remember one Daytona race where I had 120 hotel rooms for a group down there. I usually don't have groups that large anymore, but for every event, I will have hotel rooms for the number of people that I've got who are going. And that's the challenge of booking for NASCAR. Mm-hmm. There is absolutely no room for error in terms of dates and in terms of, you know, making sure that their hotel is booked the way it is supposed to be booked. Because at some of the venues in Dover, Delaware, and in Bristol, for example, if you don't have an inn with a hotel or if you don't renew your contract every year, you're not going to get a room.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And if you, for some reason, book the wrong date, you're just out of luck. You're just not going to get anything.
Well, and even, you know, those are smaller places, but even Daytona, that it sells out. So if you're not, I mean, it's bigger and there's more hotel rooms there, but still it's a huge event, right? So
if it is. Yeah, you're exactly right.
So, yeah, I'm sure that'd be a great call to tell the Earnhardts that they have to stay in Orlando because you forgot to.
Come to stay in their RV.
That would not be good. That would not have been good.
Okay, so moving from NASCAR to Israel, which there's really no way to segue that, so we'll just jump. We mentioned that you've taken several groups to Israel. Can you talk a little bit about how that started? Why your mom started taking it? Was she in the travel industry, or was this just a passion of hers?
No, she went on a group with a church group with a group that ended up being multiple buses, and she knew one of the men that had put the group together. She knew of him at least, and she fell in love with Israel. She's a student of scripture, always has been, and so she loved that part of it, which is what caused her to go in the first place. And he recognized the way she was responding to things they were discussing and the way she was looking at things, and he said, you need to take your own group. So she went back with him a second time, and after that, she started taking groups. Now, in the early stages, I would book their air and nothing else, and she did all of the planning. And then as I learned more in the travel industry, I started booking the tours. But she would plan everything from where we're going to have lunch to how many places we can see in the day. We always have an Israeli guide. By law, you have to. Well, you don't have to. There are some companies that do that, but you shouldn't. Mm-hmm. So we always have an Israeli guide, and we always, of course, have an Israeli bus driver. We have used the same bus driver for 33 years. And he and his family are like members of our family. We watched his children grow and get married and have their own children. And he's still driving for me. We have had a couple of guides through the years, but she absolutely just fell in love with it and decided that that the Lord was going to allow her to take these groups. And so every year she would pray about taking another group, and people would just sign up to go. And she, I think, was amazed by it as everybody else was. And the first time I went, I will tell you that I was on a travel agent fam. And we kind of bar hopped all through Israel. It was very different from the way we do it now. That's where I was then. And so I wasn't so keen on the idea. And the person that was her guide at that point, this was when I was working for the travel agency, the person that was her guide flew to the States and came to the agency and tried to get me into talk to me about booking groups, and the agency owner wasn't so sold on it, and I wasn't so sold on it. So it just kind of fell apart. And then I went again with her many years later and started to fall in love with it myself. And so I have been 8 times and have taken a group every 2 years. We took a group 2 years back-to-back only one time, and it just wasn't enough time to get the planning the way we like to do it, because we'll plan everything from what treats they're going to have on the bus, and the treats always have to match the place that they've just been. For example, if we've just been on the Sea of Galilee for a sail, then when they get back on the bus, they're going to get a pack of goldfish or something. It's very time consuming for me. But it's something that I absolutely love doing. And so I'm working on dates right now for the spring.
Awesome. So you said you've been eight times. So how many times had your mom been?
We're not really sure. We think that she has taken 32 groups.
Wow.
That's awesome.
But we're not positive.
Wow. So when you do these groups, do some of the same people repeat, or do you take new people every time?
There always turn out to be a few new people, but there are some. There's a lady in West Virginia, which is where my parents or my mother lives, and there is another friend of mom's who every time I announce a group, she calls the next day and says, sign me up.
Nice.
She goes every time.
That's awesome.
Wow.
And there are just some other members of her church that do that same thing. And now there are some of my friends that do the same thing. So it's just interesting. Last year was the first time that my husband has ever been. So
nice.
You just never know.
Yeah, it's one of those places that I was fortunate enough to hear a representative of the Israel Tourist Board speak a few weeks ago. And just the way she describes it, and I've always been intrigued by Israel, and many people have, but to hear it come from somebody's mouth, you know, somebody who's been there and lived there, it really, and she was actually very funny as well. So I think one of my favorite jokes she told was that it was about the size of New Jersey, but with fewer Jews. I think that was so.
I heard the same woman speak at ASTA last year.
She's so funny. Was she not funny? Yeah, she's hilarious.
She's hilarious.
I had someone at Chris World. I wonder.
It might be the same.
They did some great training. Yeah. And it really puts you at ease, because some people, I think, like in today's world, people would be scared to go anywhere in the Middle East, you know. But that's one thing they always stress about Israel, is that it's safe. You know, you're safe. Go there. Mm-hmm. It's safe. So.
Yeah, and Beth, you would agree with that, right? You've said that to me before.
Oh, absolutely. And I will say that El Al, which is the Israeli airline, they're the only airline that did not have to change anything after 9/11, because they always have and still do interview individually everybody before they get on the plane.
Hmm.
They set up, they look like band podiums, for lack of a better word. The little, what you used to put your band music on, or if you were the director, you'd put your music on. And they set four or five of them out, and everybody that comes through the line, they ask questions. And when Mom and I were doing groups, this hasn't happened in probably 10 years, but it used to be that one of us would get a phone call from the security and ask a series of about 20 questions about the group, and then I would call Mom, or she would call me and say, they just called, they'll be calling you next. And sure enough, they would call and ask the same questions. And of course, we tell people, you know, be honest, but this is not a joke to them.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make a joke about it, because they take it very seriously. And the other thing is that our guide and our driver live there. And there have been times when there were protests or something going on, and so he would just take us a different way. He would just take us through a different neighborhood, to the extent that some people never even knew we had veered off from our regular course. I will say that we do not give at 9 o'clock we're going to go to Jaffa, and at 10:30 we're going to go to the to see that where they signed the Declaration of Independence. We say we're going to do these things today. And the reason that we do that instead of giving a timeline on it is so that if we have to change the direction we're going or the schedule for whatever reason, we can do it without upsetting people's
Right.
Feeling.
And that's very typical of any escorted tour. You know, we get that question a lot. Well, I want to know exactly when we'll be done so I can meet my sister for dinner or whatever. And it doesn't work that way. They don't tell you that, not because they want to be secretive, but because they want to keep your expectations where they can at least meet them, if not exceed them. So, you know, because things go wrong all the time. But if you don't know about it, then it didn't go wrong. If you don't really know what
that's right.
Expected.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right, so we're almost out of time, but I did want to ask you one other thing, which we always, whenever we do one of these Meet the New Agents, we always ask them, and we read off your very impressive list of all the places you've been. So what is that bucket list that's sort of niggling at you, that bucket list trip that might be the next one that you really need to check off the list?
Surprisingly, I have not done any of Asia. I've not been to Cabo. Cabo is probably where I would like to go next. After that, it will be Australia, New Zealand,
nice.
Fiji. I haven't been to any of those places. Obviously, I'm not going to do all three of those in one trip, but to go west from here as opposed to going east is something that I'm really interested in doing.
Cool. That's a good answer. Actually,
Australia is probably the biggest.
Australia is a popular answer among all of us, so maybe that's what our Outlander 10-year anniversary trip needs to be. Is Australia.
I'm saving now.
That's a great idea,
yeah.
Elizabeth.
Those two, the Australia and New Zealand, come up, I think, the most when we ask
all my
questions.
Kids will be like in college, and I won't have that guilt of like traveling to Australia.
And we could call it Outlander Does the Outback.
Oh, we need a logo and t-shirts, and we are good to go. All right. Well, thank you so much. That is our show for this week. We welcome your comments and feedback on this episode or any episode, really. To leave comments, visit us at outlandertravel.com. Then click podcast at the top of the page and find the episode you wish to comment on. Or you can like us on Facebook by just searching for Fly Away. And please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We want to once again thank Beth, heartfelt thanks to Beth, for joining us tonight and sharing her travel experiences with us. Thank you, Beth.
Yay.
On behalf of Laura,
a lot of fun.
We're so glad you were here. On behalf of Laura, Sandy, Lindsay, and myself, Elizabeth, thank you for joining us here at Outlander Travel, and we'll see you next week. Gotta fly.